Good afternoon to everyone, and a tremendous welcome from all of us, from the Kohelet Yeshiva family, the students, the entire community, to Senator and Mrs. Lieberman. So before we even give a formal introduction, just once again, just a tremendous round of applause. And we'll have the opportunity, as I'll mention in a second, to ask some questions, but I think it's really true from the outset that I speak on behalf of all of us, the students, our families, the entire Kohelet and larger Philadelphia area community, that your mission, Senator and Mrs. Lieberman, and your commitment to marry religion to public service is a true testament, and I think above all, a model. A model for every single young person in this room, a model of that which we aspire toward in our own public service, whether it be professional or whether it be voluntary. But it's truly an inspiration and truly a sense of synergy, and that your role model and that your inspiration, the path in which you have walked, has truly inspired so many of us. Just a word of introduction to the program before reading the formal bios for both of our honored guests today. We'll have an opportunity to hear from the Senator for just over 20 minutes. After his remarks, as I mentioned this morning, any of you who has a question for either Senator or Mrs. Lieberman, we have a microphone here in the front, and I'll be happy to share that with you. So that's going to be the schedule. So first the Senator, and then we'll open it up to any questions that you might have. Just briefly, we could be here for a long time with just the bios, but just the short version of really both. Perhaps known as best known as the Democratic candidate for Vice President in 2000, Senator Lieberman has established himself as a national leader, one who works across party lines to find common ground, a person who speaks his conscience, and who gets things done for the good of people across America. Senator Lieberman has been a public servant since 1970. He has served as Connecticut State Senator, the Attorney General of the State of Connecticut, and then represented Connecticut in the U.S. Senate for more than 20 years. In the course of his career, Senator Lieberman has been influential in promoting our national security, strengthening the U.S. military, supporting public schools, protecting the environment, defending the rights of gay and lesbian Americans, and has written extensively on the dignity and nobility of public service. In 2012, Senator Lieberman published The Gift of Rest, Rediscovering the Beauty of the Sabbath, in which he reflected on his career as an observant Jew in the United States Senate. Mrs. Hadassah Lieberman dedicated much of her life's work to health issues, assisting nonprofit organizations, improving educational standards, and promoting international understanding. Recently, Mrs. Lieberman has joined Susan G. Komen for the Cure as a global ambassador. She has worked on global women's health issues as well as microfinance projects, which are improving the social status of women as they alleviate poverty. In addition to her professional responsibilities, Mrs. Lieberman also has devoted the considerable time and energy to community service causes, including Best Friends, Meridian House, the Auschwitz Jewish Center Foundation, and the Multiple Sclerosis Society. It gives me tremendous honor at this point to call upon Senator Lieberman for some preliminary remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi, and thanks to all of you for a warm welcome to my wife, Hadassah, and to me. The way to describe the program is that I will speak for a while, and then there'll be a question and answer, at which point Hadassah will help me with the answers. So see, this you thought this was funny. Right? And this means that, as always, she gets the last word. So you're going to, Holly, if you like that, I'm going to tell you this story that, you know, I ran for vice president in the year 2000. It was a crazy election, not quite as crazy as the one we just finished, but we got more votes than the other ticket, but we had a disputed count in Florida, and it recounted for 36 days, and then finally a court decision awarded it to the other side. So the next morning, we were in our house, all quieted down, we're having a cup of coffee, and Hadassah said to me, "Sweetheart, I know you're disappointed by the result of the election, and you're probably even a little depressed, and let me just assure you that in this house, you will always be vice president." And it happens to be true. So I'm really delighted to be here. I can't help but asking, you know, schools usually have mascots, you know, like the school I went to had a bulldog as a mascot. What does a school named Kohelet have as a mascot? Or do you not have one? Oh, that's great. Okay, good. Okay, so the topic that they've asked me to speak about, and really I'll try to do it as quickly as I can and then leave time for questioning, is what is the value of Shabbat for young people in today's world? What's the value of Shabbat for young people in today's world? So, I still consider myself middle-aged, but I'm definitely not young. So I'm going to give you the perspective of my own lifetime and hope it speaks to you in some way. As the rabbi was good enough to mention, a few years ago, I had the opportunity to write a book about Shabbat called The Gift of Rest. And I called it a gift from Hashem to the Jewish people and from the Jewish people to the world, because as my life has gone on, I really have experienced Shabbat as a gift, not as a time of restriction, not as a kind of burden, but really as a gift and a source of reinvigoration and perspective and pleasure. But I will tell you that I did not always feel that way. I was raised in a modern Orthodox family in Connecticut. We observed Shabbat. When I went to college, really without much thinking, maybe to conform to what was happening around me, whatever, I stopped observing Shabbat. It was sort of interesting to me, and sometime I'll go to a psychiatrist to help me understand this. I continued nonetheless to put on tallis and tefillin and daven every morning. But I stopped observing Shabbat. I guess in some weird way I thought, gee, if I can't do my schoolwork on Shabbat, maybe I'm not going to make it here at this college, which was ridiculous as I look back at it. And I say maybe some of it was just because I was conforming with the rest of what was happening in the community. In my class of 1,000 students, there were 4 who identified as modern Orthodox. It was very different than it is today. And then, to make a long story short, I got out of college, I went to law school, and I began to miss the Shabbat, and then my grandmother, my mother's mother, at the age of 86, passed away. She was a very important person in my life. Called her by the Yiddish Baba. Other people are called Bubby, but she was a Baba. And there was a way in which my beginning to miss Shabbat combined with her death to make me feel that I had a choice to make now, that the proverbial line of Jewish history and destiny into the future, a link in the chain now was gone from earth, and I had to decide whether I was going to continue it or not. And I began to come back to Shabbat observance step by step, little by little, until I became fully observant of Shabbat and the Chagim and all the rest. And I, as they say, I've never turned back since, because increasingly Shabbat observance has become important to me. The busier I became, when I got into public life as an attorney general, as a U.S. senator, the more Shabbat was important to me, not just as a day of rest, though that was very important. I always say to people, remember that in the Ten Commandments, the commandment related to Shabbat first says that you're supposed to work for the 6 days of the week and rest on the seventh. And I always have found that I was able to work harder and get more done on the 6 days of the week because I knew the seventh day was coming. But I want to go back a little bit and say, that part of why I think Shabbat is of value to young people, middle-aged people, and older people in the world today is because it answers fundamental questions that everyone at one point or another asks ourselves about our lives. Way back in 1992, there was a third-party candidate for president named Ross Perot, and he chose as his running mate somebody nobody knew, a retired war hero, a wonderful man named Admiral James Stockdale. And in the vice presidential debate that year, Stockdale got up at the beginning and said, and this became in that period of time like a familiar line, you're probably asking yourselves two questions about me. Who am I? And what am I doing here? And really, those are the kinds of questions that every one of us at some point in our lives asks ourselves. Who am I? And what am I doing here? And the Shabbat, which is part of the Brit, the covenant that we have with Hashem, going back to Avraham Avinu, beginning in this parsha, Lech Lecha, and then particularly being made express at Har Sinai in the Ten Commandments given to Moshe Rabbeinu, the observing of Shabbat is part of the covenant, but it really does answer some big questions, which is that we're not here by accident. We believe we're here as a result of a divine act of creation. What are we doing here? Well, what we think we're doing here, if we accept the Brit, is to try to implement Hashem's law, as it was expressed to us on Har Sinai in the Ten Commandments and the Torah overall. And there's also, and as you have studied, I'm sure, the commandment of Shabbat observance is mentioned twice in the Torah. The first time it's related to creation. The second time it's related to the Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt, which to me has always said that not only did God create the world and us, but God preserves, and as occurred in Egypt, the capacity to re-enter history to protect his people and his values. But that's the serious part of it. The other part of it that really meant a lot to me and why I experience it as a gift, and I you may be challenged in the next phase of your life, as I was when I went to college. You may want to conform to what's fashionable around you. But trust me, just like Kohelet, I tried all the other stuff. And in the end, what was most satisfying and my first choice was to observe Shabbat for the reasons I've said, but also to step back, to get some perspective, to look at the week that passed and think about the week ahead, to spend time with family and with friends. And so these rules of Shabbat that come from the Torah and were implemented by the rabbis over the years, which could be seen as limiting and constricting. Some people, if they were really angry, could say enslaving. At a point in your life, maybe you've already experienced it, I hope, they become actually liberating because they protect us from what we do on the six other days of the week. I write in my book about Shabbat that probably the hardest moment for me, as the sun sets on Friday and Shabbat approaches, is to put away my smartphone and to let it go for 25 hours. That's hard. But once I do, I feel really liberated by it. I'll tell you a story about this. The Shabbat Observance Shabbat book has usually gotten very positive reactions from people who are not Jewish, but a short story. A man named Cecil Samuelson, who at that point was the president of Brigham Young University in Utah, the great Mormon university, told me that he had read the book and he realized that his BlackBerry was interfering with his observance of his Sabbath on Sunday. So he turned it off. He said to me, for the first 2 or 3 weeks, this created a panic on the Brigham Young campus because they couldn't reach the president. But then he said they came to understand why, and I always knew, and they knew, that if something really serious had happened, they could do what we used to do not so long ago, before smartphones. They could come and knock on my door, or they could call me. He doesn't have the same prohibition about using the phone that we do. And I was quite touched by that story, because he was saying basically that he needed to be liberated from something interfering with his observance of Shabbat. I'll just say a few more things and then I will open for questions and I'll ask Hadassah to come up. Sometimes people, you know, there's a favorite, well, let me pose the question. People would say to me, how can you be in politics, the Attorney General of Connecticut, the United States Senator, and still observe Shabbat? And my answer echoed a famous poet and writer in Israel, Ahad Ha'am, who said it's not so much that the Jewish people have kept Shabbat as that Shabbat has kept the Jewish people. And so my answer always was, I don't know how I could be a United States Senator without observing Shabbat. Sometimes my non-Jewish colleagues would say to me, one of them said to me, who was Catholic, I think I'm going to convert for the weekends, because I love this idea that you don't have to go to political events on Friday night or Saturday. So I must say that not only was that important to me as to how I was able to do my job, but I think it ultimately earned a lot of respect from people. When I first started out as a state senator, and I wouldn't come to, you know, a political picnic on a Shabbat afternoon, or on Friday night there would be a testimonial dinner for somebody who would help me in my campaigns. And when I'd say I couldn't come, people would be puzzled, and some of them actually would be angry. But then when they realized that I was, two things, I was doing this as a matter of religious faith and observance, and two, I was doing it consistently. In other words, I wasn't just not coming to their dinner or their picnic. Not only did they accept it, they respected it. I'll tell you one or two brief stories about this, which I hope you'll remember. One is, when I was running for U.S. Senator, I was an underdog. I was running against an incumbent, and he was way ahead in the polls, and I pulled a little more close, but still everybody assumed I was going to lose. Does it sound familiar? And about a week before the election day, I got a call from a friend of mine who had been in the state Senate with me. His name was Cornelius O'Leary. As I always like to say, he was neither Sephardic nor Ashkenazi. He was Irish Catholic. And he said, you know, I think you're going to win the election. And I said, Connie, that's great, because sometimes I think maybe it's only me and you who think that. Why do you think it? He said, I went to visit my mother yesterday, and she had three other Irish Catholic ladies in their 70s. That was a year of a presidential election, and my friend O'Leary tried to convince them why they should vote for the Democrat. They were all voting for the Republican, who was President Bush, 41. And so my friend O'Leary said to his mother and the other women, well, what about the Senate race with Lieberman and Weicker? And he said, my mother said, oh, that's easy. Well, I'm voting for Weicker and all my, excuse me, I'm voting for Lieberman, and all my friends are too. So O'Leary said, why is that so easy? And his mother said, I really respect the fact that he's a religious person, that he doesn't do politics on his Sabbath, that he puts God and his family ahead of his political career. So I wasn't observing my religion because I took a public opinion poll that said that Mrs. O'Leary would react that way. But you know, there were 1,300,000 votes cast in that election, and I won by just a few more than 10,000, way less than 1%. So who's to say what affected them? The second is to make this point to you, and then we'll go to the questions. We are really blessed to live in this country, and particularly to live at this time in this country, because it wasn't always this way, where I think my whole career in politics should say to you that if you decide to continue to be religiously observant, it will not stop you at all from realizing your career secular goals, whatever business, profession, anything else you want to go into. And here's my favorite recent story about that. A friend of mine who I would call traditional conservative Jewish, one of his children became a Baal Tshuva and became really Orthodox. Nebuch, you know, this happens, right? And the son who became Orthodox, went to law school, did very well, got hired by a prominent Washington law firm. And my friend told me this story. He said, I said to my son Michael, Michael, I'm going to say something to you. You're not going to be happy, but I'm your father. I've been around longer than you are. Do not wear your kippah to the law firm. I hate to say this to you, but it's going to stereotype you. It's going to caricature you. They won't see anything but the kippah. It's going to inhibit your progress at the law firm. And my friend Stuart said to me, we went back and forth for 2 or 3 days on this, and finally my son said, okay, Dad, I'll take your advice. So first day at the law firm comes, that evening, my friend calls his son and says, Michael, how was it? He said, oh, it was great, Dad. You know, they very nice people. And they gave me some very interesting cases to work on. And incidentally, Dad, I changed my mind and I put my kippah on. So my friend said, why? Well, he said, because the partner who's managing my work is wearing a kippah. And so that is the world that you're blessed to be going out into. I hope you carry some of the stories and some of the confidence that I have based on the life that I've been able to live and still do live in this great country. So with that, I call to the stage my beloved wife. If there ever was an Eishes Chayil, this is her, Hadassah Freilich Lieberman. Yeah, sure, that'd be good.
Questions. Hey guys, questions. Get up your hands.
Pass down the mic.
Oh boy, you decide. Okay, Mr. Kirchner, thanks. If I ask you a question, can you just say your name before you actually ask the question? You can direct it anyone. You can direct it at the senator, to his wife, to both.
I think I just turned my microphone on.
Oh, God.
I hope you could hear me before.
Okay, now.
Okay, who's got the questions?
I'm Shai Goldman. And I know you're famous for supporting gay rights. Is that, did you separate that from your religious views on the matter, or do you see them as interlocked?
It's a really good question. So I suppose I do, to answer your question directly, separate them in one sense from my religious views, because I try to be guided by the Torah and those views in my personal life. But in another sense, I think my support of gay rights is consistent with the fundamental message and value system of the Torah, which is that we all were created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. And what someone's sexual orientation is doesn't alter that. And certainly is not a ground for discriminating against that person in housing, employment, and now in our time in marriage. I must say that I was going back to the 1970s in the state legislature, I was an advocate for gay rights legislation. I will tell you that on the question of same-sex marriage, it took me a while to come along because I kept feeling, okay, you know, I've supported domestic partnership rights legislation and all the sort of compromises leading up to that. But I kept saying, don't we want to put a special status on heterosexual marriage as the preferred way for people to be together? And then in my state of Connecticut, first the Supreme Court found the existing laws which prohibited same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional, and then the legislature made same-sex marriage legal. And somebody asked me about 2 or 3 or 4 months later, how has that changed things in life in Connecticut? And, you know, I thought about it for a minute, and I said, as far as I can determine, all it means is that 2 men or 2 women can go down and get a marriage license, just like a man and a woman can. In other words, it did not affect, in my from anything I've been able to see, the majority inclination, which is to have traditional heterosexual marriage. So, but let me come back to the point the main point, which is that to me, you know, I was involved in the civil rights movement in the '60s. I was an advocate for women's rights in the '70s and '80s. And it seemed to me that the question of gay rights was consistent with that. And all of it, if you asked me where did I get that from, well, there's no question. I think it's part of the promise of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. But in my case, I think it's also part of the sort of fervent ethic of equality that comes out of the Torah. I understand that not everybody in the Orthodox world feels this way. I'm going to stop there. I was about to tell you the story. Okay, go ahead.
Stand up and answer. With your experience in your election 2000, proceeding to the popular vote but not electoral vote,
yeah.
And this past election was really proceeding to the popular vote but not to the electoral
right.
vote, do you think that the electoral college should be eliminated or changed anyway?
Do you want to do that or do you want me to do it?
Well, our experience, I'd rather you do it, but yeah. Our experience with it, and actually some of what we're experiencing right now, there's a little deja vu-y stuff in it. And we've all been troubled with the Electoral College. And what happens is people get troubled, and then, you know, some months go by, years go, and nothing happens. So it seems inevitable, because we were shocked in 2000. Nothing happened.
Yeah. So I would say that the Electoral College is a relic of an earlier time that really should be eliminated, but I'm not so sure it will be. And now I'll come back and explain why. It also shows that the men who gathered here in Philadelphia in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention were bold progressives. They were breaking away from the English crown, and they were creating a republic, a democracy. I mean, some of the declaration. Why did they say in their Declaration of Independence, they're forming the new government to secure the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as the endowment of our Creator to every person. On the other hand. In reality, they were a little bit worried about where all this was going to go. And they created, it's pretty clear from the transcripts of the debates at the Constitutional Convention, the Electoral College as a break on a popular vote that they, the elite, the men who were at the, who were great men, really, at the Constitutional Convention thought would be crazy. Somebody unprepared to be president. And the electors would be chosen by essentially the elites in their state. There'd be other members of the elite that usually be, some states, most states had requirement that they be property owners, therefore they would be a backstop, a break to the people going crazy. Well, that's very, when I will tell you that when we went through what we did in 2000, you know, I was on the Armed Services Committee, I traveled around the world a lot, seeing our troops, meeting foreign leaders, they came to visit me. They would always ask, now explain this to me. How could you and Al Gore, who was running for president that year, get 540, well, I know it too well, they'd say over 500,000 more votes than the other candidates, and yet you didn't take office, and this is supposed to be the greatest democracy in the world. And I have to explain the Electoral College, but the question really cannot be answered today. Now, why do I think it's probably not going to be repealed, or I hope I'm wrong? Because the small states have a big effect, and the partisanship in some of the other states means that who they vote for will be a foregone conclusion. So, California, New York, Texas, three big states, may change over time, but now the candidates didn't campaign much in New York or California. They just went there to raise money because everybody assumed those two states are going Democratic. Texas is going Republican. Florida was the only big state that, again, was uncertain. And the other states that really decided it, Pennsylvania was a battleground state, so I'd say Pennsylvania is medium size anyway. Michigan, medium size. And then some smaller states like New Hampshire were thought to be capable of deciding it. And smaller states like New Hampshire don't want to yield that power that they have. But if you think the Electoral College is wrong, I urge you to take this on as a mission, because you will be making our democracy better than it is today. As you know, Hillary Clinton got more votes on Tuesday. Yeah, so.
Hi, I'm a teacher, Barry Kirsten. Yes. Today's Veterans Day, and you are a strong supporter of the military and veterans. And you also have a close friend who's one of the most famous veterans in the country, John McCain. I'm wondering, should you meet President-elect Trump, will you demand an apology friend
whose heroism was to meet? Well, McCain just goes on. I mean, he came out for Trump, and then when those tapes came out with the sexual comments and anti-woman comments, McCain withdrew his support. So at some point they're going to meet each other, and I bet that Trump will apologize, because, in fact, after this often happened during the campaign with Trump, he would say something sort of either way out or outrageous, and then he'd come back in by the end of the week and say, I didn't mean that. Of course John McCain is a hero. He said that at one point a week afterward. It was almost as if he was being light about it. But look, he got elected according to, I was going to say fair and square, except for the Electoral College, but that's not his fault. He got elected according to the rules and laws of our country. And now we just have to give him, I was for Clinton, give him an opportunity to prove that he can bring the country together and govern effectively. And part of that will be avoiding saying some things like you said about McCain. I mean, there was a moment in the campaign, not just because John McCain is one of my best friends ever, but just because he was McCain, a war hero. When Trump said that about him, I think not only I, but everybody I knew in politics said, that's it. The Trump campaign is over. But it wasn't over. And he kept saying things. I mean, I think a lot of us in politics felt like we were, and this is the metaphor I was using, that as if I was a high wire walker, you know? And I was with a group of high wire walkers, and we looked up, and there was a wire strung between these two very high skyscrapers in New York, and there was a guy up there jumping up and down and not falling. He would just somehow always come back to the wire. It was amazing. And to us, that's the way the Trump campaign looked. And here he is. Yes.
Hello, my name is Rachel Cruciani. I'd like to ask you, what advice would you have for a young Jew who's interested in going into government?
Thank you for asking. You should begin that.
Well, I think during the campaign, and I know Joe was talking about Shabbat and the campaign, one of the things that hit us most, I think, was Shabbat on the campaign trail and how people really followed us, how people are really interested and involved. So when you ask what I would say about a Jewish person in government, there are Jewish people in government, all over the government in Washington and local. And I think what I would say to everyone, whether they go into government or medicine or law or construction, when you're a Jew and you're an observant Jew, you have to stand tall, be proud, and represent. You're not just representing yourself, you're representing a whole community. And that's why people say, oh, well, what's the public relations we have, whether it's with Israel, whether it's with Jews? It's us. We are the PR. And we are the PR of people in government. Because you're it. And you're able to, these days, help make the ground rules of how you look and how you are and how you act. And we're strong.
Were you thinking about going into politics or government generally? First, Hadassah's right. Don't feel inhibited or limited in any way by your religious observance. The second thing is, I happen to have taken this path to be involved in elective politics. But there are a lot of other great and constructive and satisfying things to do in government. I mean, obviously, one is to support candidates who share your beliefs. But the other is to work as what we call in this country a civil servant. Work in the government. Work in education. Work in homeland security. Work in environmental protection, public health, national security, defense, etc. There are enormously important jobs to be done that have real consequence for our society. You're not going to get rich, but the salary level is not bad, and the retirement benefits are good. So I hope you'll think about that. And again, the federal government, most state governments, the local governments really do respect. For instance, if you want to take Shabbat, because most people don't want to work on Shabbat anyway, so that's probably not going to be an issue, but the Chagim off, people understand provide for that. I'll just tell you a quick story. It's a little strange, but there's a man named, does anybody recognize the name Harry Reid? Well, yes. Harry Reid is the Democratic majority leader. He's retiring this year. He's a character. We were friendly when I was there. One day we were walking along, talking about some issue, and then out of the blue he said, you know, I've been meaning to ask you this question. I see a lot of these young people around here. Harry's not Jewish. He's a Mormon. He said, I see a lot of these young people around here, staff people, and they're wearing yarmulkes, is what he said. So you're an Orthodox Jew. Why don't you wear a yarmulke? So I said, you know, Harry, it's an awkward question for me, but it's really generational. I grew up in a town in Stamford, Connecticut, where the only person to wear a kippah, to him I said a yarmulke, was the rabbi. And most of the time when the rabbi was walking around the street, he was wearing a felt hat and not a yarmulke. But fortunately, things have changed. I said, if it makes you feel any better, I want you to know I wear a yarmulke all the time when I'm home. And I said to one of these young people you're looking at now, and it's true, the Capitol is loaded with staff people, young people who are wearing kippot. I said, before long, one of those young people is going to end up being a senator or a member of the House, and that'll answer your question.
Hi, my name is Shoshana.
Yes.
I was wondering what you think about the Hamilton phenomenon, the musical specifically, about connecting our goals today with the goals of the founding fathers.
Yeah, and what phenomena did you
call? Hamilton.
Hamilton.
Oh, Hamilton.
Uh-huh.
It's a good thing we saw it.
Yeah. Well, the there are parallels. There's a limit to the parallels between the Constitution and its interpretation by succeeding generations of judges and lawmakers, and the Torah and its interpretation, particularly after the Beit Mikdash was destroyed, by succeeding generations of Rabbeim to try to interpret it. And look, I think you always want to use, now I'm coming to the constitutional system, leaving the Torah for a moment. You always hope that you have judges who will give a central place to trying to determine what the intention of the founding fathers was in drawing the Constitution. But it's clear that the founding fathers simply could not have imagined a lot of the specific issues that come before courts in 2016, because the world has changed so much. And therefore, and this of course happens in rabbinic law as well, adjusting to changes in reality. And so I think to the best you can, you have to stick to the original intention, but you can't stick to it to the point that it doesn't recognize what the world is today. I hope that helped. You can't draw a law about this. This is sort of bandied about in campaigns. People will say, I will only appoint presidential candidates.
Right.
Someone to the Supreme Court who will follow the intention of the framers of the Constitution. Well, everybody should want to do that to the extent that they can. But honestly, can I tell you what James Madison would have thought about Obamacare or same-sex marriage? No. So you have to count on the sense of the judges to do that.
Hi, my name is Maytal. You said before that you originally went to law school.
Yes.
So what made you decide that you didn't want to be a lawyer, you wanted to go into politics, and when did you decide that?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I guess the direct answer to the question is that I went to law school in a way for both reasons, because I was interested in the law as a career, but by the time I went to law school, I was also beginning to think seriously about going into politics, and I thought that having a law degree would be helpful to me in politics. I don't mean to help me get elected, but because so much of the politics in office is about adopting laws, enforcing laws, etc. So, I mean, I'll tell you just briefly that it's a long time ago, but when I went into college, Senator Kennedy from Massachusetts was elected president, John F. Kennedy. And for my generation, he was a real hero. I mean, he gave this wonderful inaugural address, which if you haven't read, I urge you to do. And one of the memorable lines was, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." And that was a real ethic public service. Drew a lot of people of my generation into being interested in politics. I read a lot of biography and history, which from high school on, which deepened my interest because it showed me what a big effect leaders can have for good or bad. And I worked a couple of summers on Capitol Hill for the senator from Connecticut. So by the time I graduated from law school, if you had asked me, Lieberman, what's your dream? What do you really want to be? I wouldn't have answered your question, because the true answer was too presumptuous. But the answer inside my head was, I would dream of being a U.S. senator. And so I was lucky enough to live the dream. And the law helped me to do that. But I have practiced law along the way. I practiced for the first 12 years out of law school before I became Attorney General of Connecticut. And then after I left the Senate, I went back and joined a law firm in New York. And I've been half time, and I've enjoyed it a lot. So the law is, I wouldn't recommend, and don't tell your parents I said this, because, you know, I want you to have a sense of purpose. To some extent, the law can be like the extension of college, because it really, it enables you to practice law, but it probably helps you do an enormous number of other things. Our two older children went to law school, and neither one of them is practicing law. One's involved in insurance, and the other runs a foundation. But they both say to us that the fact that they went to law school really helps them do what they're doing now better.
But it's sort of these days that way of thinking may be a little outdated with this election. You see, a businessman got in. So who's to say if that happens again?
Right. No, that's a good point.
This will be the last question.
Hi, I'm Ralph Friedman. I was just wondering if you could ever discuss whether Jewish ideologies or values on hold for a second to support an act or legislation or policy that was good for common secular Americans.
Wait, no, I missed that. Say that again. I'm sorry.
I was just wondering if you ever need to put your Jewish values on hold so you could support a policy that was good for common Americans.
Ah, okay. Very good question. I'm asked that a lot. I was when I was in office. And this is not quite like the answer to the question about the judges. But so when I took office as a state senator, as an attorney general, as a U.S. senator, in all cases, you put your hand on the Bible. In my case, I had a little Torah that I used, and you pledge. You take an oath, really, and the oath has significance halachically to protect and enforce the Constitution and the laws of the state or country. And to me, that was always, that had to be my first priority. If there was ever a conflict between what, let's say specifically what Jewish law said to me and what I thought according to what the society needed or what my constituents wanted was most important. But I also would always say to people that I didn't call my rabbi to ask him how I should vote. The voting was the result of all my experiences in life, of things I had learned, reading, etc., my evaluation of a particular issue. But I would be fooling myself and others if I said that the fact that I was Jewish, that I had been schooled in Jewish values, did not at some level, even if subconscious, affect what I was doing. I mean, I said this in my answer to the question about gay rights. It's certainly true, probably even more so. I was very active in my career in environmental protection. And there's no question in my mind that this comes from my, you know, belief in divine creation and the place that we place on not only developing Gan Eden, but protecting it, guarding it, as it says in the Torah. I grew up with an ethic that from my grandmother, but it's really right from Torah and Halakha, that we couldn't eat until we fed our pets, because they couldn't feed themselves, and they were part of the creation as much as we were. And that made me into something of an animal rights legislator. Anyway, so I think that's as good an answer as I can give you. Sweetheart, do you want to get the last word?
No, the only thing I wanted to add when you were, that some kids, when we were, there was someone who was in a job, and she was applying for this job, and she was talking to the people who were going to employ her, and then she said, I'm Sabbath observant, and they sort of looked at her, they didn't know what she was saying, and this was during, you know, 2000, and she said, you know, like Joe Lieberman, he got it right away. And when I heard that story, I said, Baruch Hashem, that's nice. It's a nice contribution.
So we accomplished something.
Yeah.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Before everyone heads out, so first of all, once again, thank you so much to Senator Mrs. Lieberman. Guys, give me one more sec before everyone's out. Two more things. First of all, we would not have this extraordinary opportunity if it were not for the Kohelet Foundation, to Mr. and Mrs. Magerman, as well as Mrs. Holly Cohen. So we want to recognize and thank the foundation for everything. Guys, if you're going to be in Lorraine this Shabbos, there are lots of other opportunities to hear from the center and hear from his wife as well. So there's Noneg tonight at 8:30 at the Magerman home. And then there's Tefillah here tomorrow. If you want to have coffee, get up really early at 8:15. And there's a lecture also following Tefillah at 11:15. Feel free to drop in if you happen to be around for Shabbos. Everyone have a wonderful Shabbat. All the best.